BBC Radio 4 FM now, it's our Book of the Week. Shop Girl is written and read by Mary Portis. It is a week since her mum died, unexpectedly, from meningitis.
We sit silently at the kitchen table. We can't use the one in the living room yet, not without her. We move around the house almost apologetically, not knowing how to fill it properly. Come on, everyone, my oldest brother Michael says as he puts plates in front of us. Eat up now. Everyone looks silently at their food. Mum would never have made lamb with leeks, nor would she have bought potted shrimps and pate. Michael is doing his best to look after us all, but my brothers seem lost and my sister Tish cannot stop crying. I want to scream at her. She looks like a wounded animal. So does Dad. When he put his arm around me at the funeral earlier, he felt smaller somehow. It's as if we've all been sent spinning in different directions, and he's the furthest one away. When we got into the car a few days ago to go to the funeral director's, he had sat behind the wheel for a moment before his face crumpled and tears started to run down it.
Oh, you've got all your lives ahead of you now. And I've got nothing. She's gone. I've got nothing now.
He wiped furiously at his face before starting the car and we didn't say another word. But I knew in that moment that Dad couldn't be the one to keep us all going now. He was lost in his own grief. And soon Michael would be leaving because his job took him away to a lot of places like Scotland and even Saudi Arabia. Tish was at college in London during the week and would only be back at weekends. It would be my brothers Joe and Lawrence, Dad and me, from Monday to Friday. And Dad could hardly do a thing for himself, let alone us. A chasm had opened up in our family, and I knew instinctively that I must stop everyone disappearing inside it. Mum would never have wanted us to fall apart without her. We limp on through the summer, clinging together, turning in on ourselves as we shut out the world. Each night we sit in the front room talking about Mum, remembering her, not daring to stop talking for fear of losing her presence. The television doesn't go on. It would just seem too normal to watch it. We cannot use the living room because Mum's chair is still there. By September, Tish and Michael have started work again. Six becomes four, and I'm left with Dad, Joe, and 14-year-old Lawrence. Dad had a bad night last night and spent all evening alone in the front room listening to Joseph Locke records. He does this every night now. Dad just works, comes home, and goes into the front room.
When first I saw the love light in your eye, I dreamt the world held not but joy for me. And even though we drifted far apart...
Keep going, just keep going. All I had to do was pull everyone along with me, force them to continue, create a routine that would make my father and brothers put one foot in front of the other every morning. When school starts again, I quickly realise that on top of my A-levels, I have to decide what chores to do and when, if I'm going to stand a hope of keeping the house the least bit together. But I vacuum one day, only to find the carpets covered with muck the next, wash clothes but forgot to iron them in time for school, and constantly ran out of bread and milk. Looking out of the window as I did the dishes, I'd see weeds growing in the garden. Our home was decaying around us. I only realised that I had to change the sheets more regularly when they started to smell. The washing piled up and the ironing basket was constantly full. One day, as Lawrence left for school, I noticed that the collar of his shirt was dirty and had hardly been able to breathe when I saw it. I'd thought that heaping Omo into the washing machine would be enough to get the stains out, but it wasn't.
Mum would never have let Lawrence leave for school like that.
I have to leave school early now in order to get back in time for the shops or start cooking tea. There's no time for hanging about in the common room, listening to the radio anymore. And even though it's my passion, I can't do much drama because Lawrence has to let himself into the house if I stay late for rehearsals, which I don't like him to do too often. Miss Coleman has helped me apply to RADA, but I can't really think of what it might mean. The future doesn't seem real now. It's all I can do to get through each day, so I scramble out the door as soon as the final bell goes, knowing that Dad will want to eat as soon as he gets in. My stomach growls. I couldn't eat a thing earlier. I was too nervous. I'm standing in a large rehearsal room, surrounded by about 30 other teenagers. It is my final RADA audition. I'm wearing a pair of black Mary Janes, leg warmers and drainpipe jeans. As people around me talk about audition pieces and what we're going to have to do, my stomach rolls with nerves. They have almost overwhelmed me each time I've come to RADA to perform. I've had two auditions so far and recited Shakespearean speeches, a scene from a Brendan Behan play and a speech from Arthur Miller's A View from the Bridge. I've cried, laughed and poured everything into each performance. I wonder what Dad will say if I get offered a place. I still haven't talked to him much about RADA because I don't want to upset him any more than he is already. This morning, he was sitting at the kitchen table reading the paper as I got ready to leave.
And where are you off to?
RADA, final audition. He sighed as he turned the page.
Why you want to be doing all that, I just don't know. By your age, I was out working, not studying something that will surely never make you a proper wage.
His words ring around my head now as I look round the room.
We're going to start with some warm-up exercises and movements, the teacher says. So, first you're going to start warming up your voices and bodies by buzzing like bumblebees and working your arms.
All around me, people start humming and buzzing, wriggling around and looping their arms.
Come on now, the teacher cries. Just let yourself go. This is the start of a big day for you all.
But as people around me start to move, I'm not sure what to do. For the first time ever, I feel embarrassed to perform. Even if I do get into RADA, I don't know how I will be able to afford it. The money I earn in my Saturday job at Boots won't cover it, and Dad won't give me any extra. Dad and money is an unsolvable problem.
Will your mother always may do?
He barks at me when I tell him I've run out of housekeeping.
I don't understand why you can't too.
The thing is, I'm only now beginning to discover just how many things Dad never really understood. Not just how far Mum made so little money go, but he's like a child almost, a weight on top of a weight, without her here to keep him going. She was his compass, and now he's lost direction. But while we are all trying to keep each other going, it sometimes feels that Dad is so lost in his own sadness that he doesn't think of ours. He just wants his life to continue as it did while Mum was here. Meals on the table, shirts washed and ironed, rooms polished and vacuumed. I don't mind filling the gap. I understand that I must be the one to look after my brothers and him. But money is the only thing I ask, and it's a constant struggle. I stare at the letter from RADA before shoving it into my satchel and closing the front door. The house is silent, and my little brother Lawrence isn't in the living room. I walk upstairs to his bedroom. He's lying in bed, still in the same place he was this morning when I left for school. His face is pale and there are black shadows under his eyes.
Come on. I'll go down and get tea on. Come and sit with me. I won't make you peel the spuds or anything.
He gives me a weak smile and I walk back downstairs. Lawrence has a lot of days like this now. Days when he's so exhausted he can't get out of bed, after being up all night, unable to sleep. The more exhausted Lawrence gets, the worse his grades have become, and now he dreads going into school. A few weeks ago, he brought me home another letter from the headmaster telling Dad that he got drunk at school. And once again, I forged Dad's signature and told him nothing about what had happened. He'd only shout and scream. I put on the kettle, sit down at the kitchen table, and get the letter out of my bag. After all this time and so many auditions, I've finally been offered a place at RADA. But I can't leave home to study, and I'd hardly be here even if I carried on living in Watford and only went to London for lectures and rehearsals. I can't leave Lawrence. We are a unit. Together we have created our own way of being, however flawed. We are home, and we are together. Gulping down my tea, I hear my mother's voice in my head. Ah, you're scared, Mary Newton. And when were you ever scared in your life? But the thing is, Mum, I am. And I've felt this way almost every minute since you left. It's like the world went from technicolour to grey. And I never knew how free you made me until you weren't here anymore. Why else do you think I got into so much trouble? I knew that I always had you to catch me. But now I'm afraid. And all I want is for everyone to be okay. That's why I cook and clean and look out for Lawrence and cover up for him. I want him to keep going without you, even though I know he's finding it almost impossible. I have learnt that grief is unlike any other emotion. Happiness, sadness, excitement and anger, these come and go. Become moments that you remember only distantly when they are gone. But grief can suck you back into its chasm in a single moment. A sight, sound or smell is enough to remind you of who you lost and make grief wash over you as hollow as the very first moment you ever felt it. Lawrence was too young to lose you. Not a boy and not yet a man. He's floating in between and I just have to watch over him for just long enough to make sure that he's okay. I want you to be here again. I want it so much that sometimes the pain inside me is so strong, I think of putting my head through a window to stop it. But you're not. And being on stage doesn't feel the same anymore. How can I pretend to be someone else when each day takes everything? So yes, Mum, I'm scared. And I don't want my world to change any more than it already has. If that means staying here and not going to RADA, finding a 9-to-5 job that I can walk to and from, then that's what I'm going to do. Lawrence walks into the kitchen and sits down as I push the letter back into my bag. Hey, I'm going to get the tea on in a minute. But how about some Angel Delight first? He smiles as I walk over to the cupboard, lean down and pull out a couple of packets. Strawberry for him and butterscotch for me. It's my little brother's favourite pudding.
And tomorrow, Mary tries to build a future for herself. Shop Girl was written and read by Mary Portis. It was abridged by Joe Coombs and produced by Hannah Marshall. It's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. Now, imagine that Dr. Johnson's biographer James Boswell time-travelled. He'd then have his pick of people to immortalise, such as Sigmund Freud.
Have you read my book, The Joke and Its Relation to the Unconscious?
I fear I have not.
Why does your failure to read my book make you afraid?
Well, I fear causing you offence.
Do you think I expect everyone to have read my books?
I confess that perhaps I do, sir.
Why do you say confess? Do you feel I am someone to whom you must confess? Do you regard me as the Jewish equivalent of a Catholic priest?
In return, Freud could analyse Boswell's fruit and veg-laden dreams.
In your dream, you are burdened by a melon and a cauliflower. A melon and a cauliflower. Like a...
melancholy flower.
Precisely.
That's terrible. My dream is one cheap pun after the other.
Boswell's Lives at 11:30 this morning on Radio 4.